This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of You're Dead to Me, a history podcast for people who don't like history, or at least people who forgot to learn any at school. My name's Greg Jenner, I'm a public historian, author, and I'm the chief nerd on the BBC comedy show Horrible Histories, and for the purposes of today, I'm also the ghost of Christmas Past. Yes, as you can probably tell from the extra jingling on our intro jingle, it's the contractually obligated festive special, and today we are pulling our crackers, dangling shiny things on the tree, and basting the turkey in time-honoured tradition as we get to grips with how the Victorians celebrated Christmas. Tis the season for bowls of jolly, so I'm joined by two very special guests. In History Corner, she's an author, broadcaster and expert on Victorian popular culture. Plus, she's my fellow honorary research associate at Royal Holloway University. It's the lovely Dr. Fern Riddell. Hi, Fern.
Hi, Greg.
You feeling Christmassy?
I am.
Oh, that's good. And in Comedy Corner, boasting one of the most impressive CVs in comedy, he is a multi-award winning stand-up, presenter, writer and performer. You'll have seen him countless times on the telly. And now he's the host of the fantastic BBC Sounds podcast, Evil Genius, a comedy podcast about history. How would that even work? It is the brilliant Russell Cain. Hi, Russell. How are you?
Hello.
Now, you are famed for your upbeat energy. I think of you as a very sort of positive man who, you know, who loves kind of being enthusiastic about stuff.
I'm enthusiastic. Sometimes I can be excoriating and withering with that energy, depending on what I'm talking about.
All right.
But I am sort of, from the moment I spring out of bed, once I get the espressos going, that's how I go. I'm weirdly quick at falling asleep. It's like a sort of Cairn Terrier. I run around a park, go back in my basket.
Does that mean you're very Christmassy?
No, I am into Christmas, providing, as it is now, it's actually December. What I cannot abide is, like last year, because we have a Christmas tradition, Lindsay and me, where we put up the Christmas tree decorations together now with our daughter, and we all have fish and chips and drink ales and have like a carb day. And but... Well, because it worked out last year, she's like, we're going to have to do it on November the 20th. And it totally spoiled Christmas for me.
Oh, that's too early.
It's horrible. It's out of context. It's like, I love dancing, but if you start dancing in Asda, you're probably going to get sectioned.
Yep.
I just don't agree with Christmas early, commercially, festively, or on any other level.
All right. Well, today we are going to be tackling Christmas in the 19th century. There's a slightly different thing about today's episode, because as well as having an expert in History Corner, Dr. Fern, who's a brilliant scholar of the 19th century, of social stuff and of pop culture, that's your kind of bag.
Can you say sex, Greg?
Well, you're a sex historian as well, historian of sexuality. But as well as Dr. Fern, I have to admit that today is also my specialist subject. I wrote my undergraduate dissertation on the history of Victorian Christmas cards.
Great.
So you are being double teamed by nerds today.
I'm basically sprinting against two Usain Bolts today.
Hopefully by the end of it, three Usain Bolts will all be on an equal footing. So let's get on with it. So what do you know? Well, you start the show as ever with the So What Do You Know, where I summarise all the things I think people at home might know about the subject. And, well, let's start with the obvious. In 2018, Dan Stevens, the nice chap from Downton Abbey, played Charles Dickens in a movie called The Man Who Invented Christmas. And if you haven't read Dickens' classic novella, A Christmas Carol, then you've probably seen the Muppets version, which is a freaking masterpiece, and seriously, it's the greatest role Michael Caine has ever done. No argument, I am right. So, you're probably thinking Charles Dickens is Mr. Christmas. It all started with him, and maybe you've been told that Victorian Christmas was uncorrupted by modern commercialism. It was the good old days of festive cheer and family values before we got obsessed with manipulative schmaltz and John Lewis adverts about cute kids. But is this true? Were the Victorians as pure as their reputation? Was Dickens the primary Yuletide architect? Have we commercialised it? Or actually, was it all about money anyway? Let's find out. Dr. Fern, let's have an argument. Where do you stand on Dickens as the man who invented Christmas? Is it legit or a load of old baubles?
Well, I would say in many ways it is legitimate. Well, it is, because we have this moment where you have Dickens and the Christmas Carol in 1843. You have this incredible new style of Christmas as mass commercialisation. And I think that we see that growing throughout the Victorian period. And now it's something we really hold on to. You know, Christmas for a lot of people is Dickensian. It's snow, it's mulled wine, it's oranges, it's Tiny Tim, it's everything. So for me, in many ways, I think the Victorians are responsible for our modern day Christmas.
I would quibble with that. I would say the Victorians supercharge Christmas. I think it's a much older festive tradition. And then they come along and they pump it full of hormones.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We know that Christmas has existed for a very, very long time. Yeah. After all, it's a huge festive part of our calendar from the medieval period onwards, if not before in some form. You're right in that idea that it's something that gets supercharged by the Victorians, very much so.
All right. Let's talk Christmas trees. Russell, yes. What's the Christmas tree looking like in your house? We're talking massive Norwegian fir, fake tree.
Well, I'm from Essex, have a guess. Convincing looking, but plastic. It's older than you think it is.
Yeah.
Because it's had the bits done to it. Its baubles are slightly larger than they need to be, or it's been oppressed by other trees around it in the media.
lots of tinsel. What are we talking in terms of decorations?
To be honest with you, I'm not allowed near it. Lindsay, who isn't from Essex, my wife, she's from Manchester. She's a more the one with the designery. Okay. She's a makeup artist and designs eyelashes, so she's got the eye for making it look nice.
So actually your tree is actually quite classy and beautiful.
It's all like steels and golds. I mean, the amount she's done, I could not be asked. We have an actual grotto under the stairs, 6-foot Santa,
wow.
Reindeer, lights, all the stuff going on. It's bearable now that we've got a child.
Yeah.
Before, it was something slightly sick and Freudian about a grown woman going, look at my giant snowman. Oh, should we wear adult nappies as well, you weirdo?
So what's on top of the tree?
We've got a tiny wooden puppet of Richard Dawkins, which we put on top. No. I think it'll probably be an angel.
Okay, classic. Fern, yeah. What's on top of your tree?
A star.
Star.
It's got to be a star.
Both of those are Victorian traditions, aren't they? Those are both standard Victorian. Mine's scrap from Ice Age.
not a standard Victorian.
Not standard.
It's scrap from the Ice Age.
Scrat, you know, he's the sort of squirrel rat thing that's obsessed with nuts, and I'm allergic to nuts. So Scrat, he's obsessed with nuts in a different way. So he's on top of my tree.
Okay, cool. Can I just interrogate the terms of your initial question?
Yeah.
Because I noticed a very quick slip from did Dickens to invent Christmas to did Victorians invent Christmas.
Mm.
Well, Dickens, as far as I know, Charles Dickens is one man and the Victorians is a whole era.
It's very true. We can be pedantic. I like
Go on then.
Are we saying that Dickens, the man, invented it and the Victorians around him were infected by his manifesto of Christmasness? Or are we saying that he was just like, you know, one of the main people, or was Victoria and Albert with their Christmas tree? Was it sort of a Nehru and Gandhi type situation?
I think it's a combination, and it's more a decade. The better question would be, did this decade invent Christmas?
Which is 1840s.
It is, because that's when we get A Christmas Carol, which obviously is Charles Dickens, and it's the whole story. Its themes are of love and desire and loss and what you need to be a good person. What's the message of Christmas is, if you're not good, you will go to hell, so be good at Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And not only in the 1840s do you have this incredibly powerful message. You know, people really want to read Dickens. Dickens is like the J.K. Rowling of his day.
Yeah. Mm.
We also have Prince Albert illustrated in kind of newspapers across the country what his version of Christmas is like. So you get the Christmas tree, which is where people are like, oh, Prince Albert's got a Christmas tree.
Albert's Christmas tree is 1848. But the Christmas tree is not a Victorian import. So it is earlier. Do you know when it comes earlier, Russell? Have you got any clue?
William... Was that you before?
William the Fourth is pretty good. It's George the Third era, isn't it?
Yes.
Right.
Queen Caroline.
Queen Caroline, who was German. So it's a German tradition, isn't it?
Well, she brings it over in terms of she hangs kind of beautiful baubles and little gifts on a yew tree. And this makes the English aristocracy and then like, this is a great idea.
Literally the worst tree.
Yew
tree's sort of fallen out of favour recently, hasn't
it? Well, yeah, Operation Yew Tree has somewhat ruined the Christmas magic.
Talk about PR disaster. The yew tree will live on forever, Caroline. I can't see anything that will spoil it.
It's a very strong tradition in Germany, going back to probably the time of Martin Luther.
Well,
it is
this idea, actually. There's a war about Christmas trees between the Catholics and the Protestants, and people
is there anything they won't argue about?
No,
the war on Christmas.
Yeah, but they do
a giant condom over the Protestant tree. It's not fair.
But they like to say that it is that there was this rumour that Martin Luther did it.
Yeah.
And the Protestants were the first to invent Christmas trees. And there's no truth in that at all. We don't know, really. Christmas trees are very old. And I think what's fascinating is that Queen Caroline chooses a yew tree, which for British tradition is one of the most kind of important historically folkloric trees that we have. So she's kind of hanging it on something that symbolises a return to nature, long-standing old father time. Kind of, it's a really beautiful way of connecting to her British subjects and her British country, really.
And it becomes popular, as you say, in the 1840s and grows throughout the century. And people also decorate their houses with holly and ivy. Yeah. They're taking stuff from the natural world and putting it into the houses. And I would argue that's a response to the Industrial Revolution. Do you agree on that one?
I think because the 1840s are instrumental in when we see this shift from our old culture, which had gone before, which is pastoral and folkloric, to what has started in the really the late 1700s, which is the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. And that's led to mass urbanisation. And by the 1840s, we've got these huge, amazing cities full of people who are still trying to connect to their pastoral family roots, which are by that point only a generation or two old.
Yeah.
So they're bringing with them all the ideas of the rural pastoral past.
All right, we've moved from trees onto another new invention of the 1840s. We have some Christmas crackers in the studio. Fern, Russell, I'm asking you now to pull a cracker. So let's do a test of strength.
No correct result for this.
No, there isn't.
No, it's like Brexit.
Politics have become so complex that whoever wins is problematic.
Yeah.
Hey!
Oh, this is perfect. I've got a bottle opener in the first one.
Oh, hello.
And a mirror, a little mirror.
Oh, that
compact.
One was meant for me, clearly.
There's the hat and the joke in there.
Yeah, come on, Russell, let's have a comedy performance, please.
What do you get if you cross a prince with a Pizza Express? No, I'm joking. This is not a joke. It's actually, this will probably appeal to you nerds more. It's more a riddle. What gets wet with drying?
Oh, I don't know.
A towel.
Oh.
Oh.
I wouldn't call that a joke.
No.
It's more sort of a riddler.
I've got a joke for you.
Is it a joke or is it another teaser?
Well, I think you're going to have to be the judge of that. Why is it easy to weigh a fish?
Because of scales.
Oh, Greg, because it's got its own scales.
Okay, sorry. I killed the joke. I sat on the punchline. So I'm going to tell you the classic story of how Christmas crackers were invented, and then I think Fern is probably going to tell me I'm wrong. So here's the famous story, Russell. In 1841, there's a man called Tom Smith. He's a confectioner. He makes sweets. And he sees that the French wrap sweets in little paper, little bonbons. And he's trying to think of a way of marketing it. And it takes him ages. It takes him years and years and years. And finally, story goes, he sees a log on his fireplace crackle. And he goes, oh, brilliant. I'll put a little bit of saltpeter in there. And when you pull the cracker, it will make a bang noise. Russell, what do you think he called his crackers?
What year is this?
Sort of late 1840s.
It would have been distasteful to call it a Peterloo. Just, I was trying to think of puns on saltpeter, but that's still quite in living memory at that point. Explosive Josephs.
That's nice.
That
I mean, that's in the right ballpark.
Yeah.
He went with Bangs of Expectation.
That's not bad.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, was Great Expectations already out? Was it a pun on literary popular?
It probably would have done, but later on, yes. I mean, it sounds like a Dickensian porn film, Bangs of Expectation. It's like if you went on Pornhub, there'd be a sort of, you know, a Charles
Please,
Dickens
sir,
character.
May I have some more? You're damn right, you may have some more.
So that's the classic
Dickens.
Story.
Dickens. It's spelled different. The porn star was spelled different.
Oh, no.
My name's Charles Dickens.
Oh, no.
You started it.
You would have been very happy with that, Charles.
I didn't think of the porn connection, Greg. Don't you? Greg started the porn stuff, didn't you?
That is the classic story that Tom Smith invented.
Please tell me it's true.
Fern, you're now going to come in with your facts and ruin it.
Well, it's not that it's not true. It's like, all Victorians like to invent a story, a mythology for themselves. We've got Queen Victoria, we've got everything. And the cracker story is no different.
Ugh.
So Tom Smith is a real person. He was a confectioner, but he did not invent the cracker, and he did not invent it by hearing a log crackle in the fire.
Bah.
It was actually his brother, who's H.J. Smith, who worked in the music halls. And there's quite a high likelihood that he would have had an understanding of both stage magic and the silver filaments that were used in the early crackers that make that bang noise to be able to put them together. Because his brother Tom, as a confectioner, was really struggling to sell these sweets. And so to come up with something that was new and really exciting and could be based at Christmas was what H.J. Smith really did. And we don't know his story because no one's recorded it, because the family themselves were so good at creating this brand, because of course the Victorians commercialised Christmas.
Yeah,
that's what they did in every aspect of it.
But by the 1870s, there are hats inside them, there are jokes inside them. So the cracker that we think of is being used, people are enjoying it. I mean, I should say the Tom Smith Cracker Company still exists.
No way.
And it does.
And still makes the official crackers for the royal family. But they presumably like still the romantic story version.
They do. And I think, you know, these crackers are beautiful things, especially by the 1880s, 1890s. They're covered in incredible pieces of artwork. They had jewellery inside them. They had, again, gendered toys. Like, I've got a bottle opener and a compact mirror, which for me is fine. But it's sort of, it is this idea.
That's a good night out there.
Yeah, it is.
It's very on brand.
Look great. Leave the house.
The advertisements that Tom Smith Company put out, I really love, because they're like, these beautiful crackers, painted of people who are important, and also are for adult parties and children's parties.
Aww.
You're like, what sort of adult parties?
We're back to the porn film again, aren't we? Yeah.
But it really is. And, you know, the Tom Smiths, they really do go for it, and they become the most popular brand of the Victorian period.
That'd be the best two uncles to have. What do your two uncles do? One runs a sweet shop, one runs a magic shop. Everyone's my friend from day one.
Exactly. Amazing. Well, going from crackers, you get fun little trinkets in there. They feel a bit like gifts. So let's talk Christmas gifts, because actually, the Victorian Christmas, we see a huge surge in the way in which toys are marketed to kids. This is a moment in history where suddenly there is a marketplace for kids as a new audience. Mm.
It is, but we're throughout the Victorian period, we see this like kind of almost a fetishization of childhood, which is children should be kept as pure and innocent, and they're not tiny adults, which is often what they have been seen as in the past. This marketing of Christmas presents is something that goes for everyone, whatever family you are in. And it's not actually specifically Victorian. If you look at the 18th century, there's lots of people advertising for Christmas boxes.
Sure.
That you would go and you would find a box for you in the morning, and children should be up from five and you should be able to hear the cries through the house of what they've got in their Christmas box and how exciting it is. But in the 19th century, this targeting toys, because we've got industrialization, because we've got huge factories now that can make loads of toys, rocking horses, nutcrackers, anything you like, mass produced, suddenly more children can have an exciting Christmas than really could have had before. Because before that, it would have been very specialised and very much based on how much money you had, whether or not you got a gift at Christmas.
And the toys are put in stockings?
Well, they're put in stockings, they're left under trees, they're up by the fireplace. And what's in them is always something that you should get excited by. So it could be a skipping rope for girls, toy soldiers for boys. And one of the things I really love is that, especially in the early 19th century, for young boys, you would leave some beer.
Legends.
How young are we talking, young boys?
Really young. There is an idea, you know, drinking beer or drinking porter was like drinking water.
Yeah. Russell, what did you get for Christmas as a kid?
Or
what
beer. Did, or what we did get beer. that carried on in my house. When I was seven, Dad went, this is a Stella. we were big on Christmas. So
yeah, did you do the stocking
thing? My dad was
thing?
Not the most generous man. He's quite a tightwad, really. It was literally like three full bin bags of just... I could never sleep on the 24th either. It's the insomnia children get. Mm. Can you remember the feeling of it? It was like a physical pain of wanting it to be the morning. It was so amazing. It is terribly commercialised, but I do love giving the gifts. The older I get, the more of a buzz I get out of the being the one that gives the gift. So I'd have made an awful Scrooge.
Do you want to guess what the most common gifts were between adults? Don't go dirty. This one's a bit more clean.
I haven't initially gone dirty. I think if anything's been established today, it's that Greg has got dirty thoughts on his mind. Fruit.
Yeah. Fruit would be number one.
And no way, what a guess.
Yeah, yes. Nailed it. And the second one would be books.
Good.
Christmas
books. Books, of course.
It's a huge marketplace. Fern?
Well, books are a massive marketplace.
I wouldn't have thought literacy was... Is literacy quite high at this point?
Yeah, huge, especially from the 1870s onwards. But it's also the authors themselves realise that at Christmas they're going to get a lot of people buying their books. So
it's the birth of the Christmas special.
It is the birth of the Christmas special. Sherlock Holmes is introduced to us as a Christmas character. Oh. That's published at Christmas time. Obviously, Christmas Carol with Dickens. And one author who is absolutely desperate to make sure his book gets published at Christmas is nicknamed by his publisher A Christmas Carol. because Lewis Carroll is desperate for everyone to make sure that they are reading his books at Christmas. And he writes to his publisher sort of saying that, come on, the children are going to be asleep and they're going to be full of plum pudding. They should be lying in bed reading my books and no one will sort of will listen to him.
I think of them as summer. When I think closed minds, I think of Lewis Carroll's work. You see sunshine and fields and you think of it like a lazy summer read. Don't get me wrong, I read Christmas Carol every Christmas. Mm-hmm. That book is a success and I love Great Expectations and Hard Times. Other than that, Dickens doesn't speak to me.
That's interesting. I'm a massive Trollope fan.
I've read all Barchester. I've read all the Palaces. I love the Warden. I think I just find the characters more believable in Trollope.
Dickens was a huge Christmas... not just Christmas Carol. He used to do lots of short stories as well. Mm-hmm. So he was a really important... writer and journalist when it comes to Christmas.
One of the things he also does is he publishes All Year the Year Round, which is his magazine, and in that he always gets other authors to give Christmas stories, and normally they're ghost stories. One of the great things is we find a lot of female authors there. The problem is Dickens often takes the names off. So we only know that they're female authors when you go back and you read them.
He had a slight issue with ladies as well, didn't he?
He left his wife for a 17-year-old girl.
Yes. Yes, the word for a ghost story, incidentally, is a hierophant.
But they are a huge part of the Christmas tradition as well. Mm. And a lot of female authors, like Amelia Edwards, who was a travel explorer, she was writing ghost stories for Dickens to be published at Christmas. But if you want someone to read who is a Victorian author that you should be reading instead of Dickens, you should try Mary Elizabeth Braddon, because Braddon writes the best Victorian stories.
And she got a good Crimbo one.
She's got a lot of revenge tales.
Lovely.
I would say.
Very Tarantino.
She is.
Her first novel was called Kill William, wasn't it?
We need to move on to Father Christmas, or is it Santa Claus, or is it St. Nicholas of Myra, or Kris Kringle? Russell, what do you say in your house? Do you go Father Christmas? Do you say Santa? Who's coming down the chimney?
We say Santa, but we use both. We're bilingual. Yeah. So our Father, you have to be well, Father Christmas not coming. Oh, there goes Santa now. Yeah, we say both.
Yeah, which I think is very common across the country, probably. Yeah. Fern, where does Father Christmas come from compared to St. Nicholas? And let's focus on more recent history. Let's not do medieval stuff.
Well, let's go backwards, actually, because to say Santa Claus and Father Christmas, we might think is a really modern thing. But the Victorians were doing it from the middle of the 19th century onwards because of the American papers. The idea of Santa Claus obviously comes, we think, from 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, which is a poem that's written in the US.
Yeah.
And that...
By Clement Moore.
Well, we don't know if it's Clement Moore. He might have stolen it. But that's in the kind of the 1820s, 1830s, around that point that this comes out and it gets published. So the idea of Santa Claus comes over from the US media into ours. So you see it, you see both. But Father Christmas is a really British tradition. And there's, that's a beautiful image of him there in the red, beautiful kind of red cape and a big white beard, which is a very Victorian kind of idea of him. But he's been part of our culture for centuries. He used to be dressed in purple and gold. And there's a wonderful article in the Newcastle Current in 1742 that says he is as fat as Punch and as merry as Falstaff. He was a delight to the rich and a comfort to the poor. And it's this idea that 12 nights from Christmas Day to Epiphany is a time of joy and feasting by this beautiful, huge spirit, this character that, if you've seen A Muppet Christmas Carol, is the ghost of Christmas present. And that is the idea. That is the British tradition of who Father Christmas is.
The story of how St. Nicholas arrives in America is very confusing. We don't know.
It was the devil. Am I being thick?
Oh, that's Germanic. Krampus, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, Krampus is the
Krampus is what you get after sprouts.
Well, you have St. Nick or you have St. Nicholas in the Germanic states, and then Krampus is his almost evil twin. It's the evil spirit. It's the ghost. It's the kind of the demon with...
He's covered in fur and horns. Yeah.
So
and he will punish
Alter
you.
Ego,
yeah, it's that. Right. If you've been bad, Krampus will punish you. Mm. We don't tend to get that brought over to us. It's just a happy, fun feasting time.
Father Christmas is more secular, really, isn't it? I mean, St. Nicholas is slightly more of a religious heritage, perhaps. I mean, it's confused, but Father Christmas feels a bit more sort of pagan-y and a bit more like, you know, it's a sort of winter, almost like a visiting sprite.
British Christmas for British people.
Yeah, it's a spirit. It's this connection to an old way of thinking, an old tradition. And, you know, I love the idea of him being as merry as Falstaff, because obviously Shakespeare wrote Twelfth Night.
Yeah.
Which is about confusion and love and what you can do and how you need to find your way through to it and family and all of these things. I think that is what Christmas is supposed to be for the Victorians as much for the people who went before us.
Russell, can you have a quick guess as to what was the first moment something big happened with Santa Claus on Christmas Day 1841 in Philadelphia in America. This is sort of speaking about the history of commercialism.
I don't know when radio or the
No, it's earlier than radio.
Yeah, it feels earlier than Marconi and all that. I mean, well, I'm way into darts and a dartboard now. But what could possibly be commercial in the 1840s? It has to be something to do with post. Surely.
Good guess. So what you'd say, maybe sort of stamps or something like that?
Some sort of stamps. The only thing that could get around a country quickly at that point would be something postal, I would have thought.
Well, it's a good guess, actually.
It's a very good guess.
But, actually, this is the first time he appears in a department store.
A department store?
This is the first
store.
Time Santa, an actor is hired to impersonate Santa Claus. Fine. And he's hired by J.W. Parkinson.
I was thinking commercial as in getting across.
No, but that's his scale. You did very well with thinking, and actually stamps happen exactly that moment, 1840s is
I know,
when
I've seen that
get.
Sticks in my mind, upon the pun, as relevant to stamps, 1840. Yeah. Isn't it Penny Black or something?
Penny Black, yep, exactly, in the Penny Red.
Ripping the arse.
You're nailing this, Russell. So 1841 is when we get Father Christmas, or rather the American St. Nick, turning up in department stores entertaining kids. So actually the commercialism is already happening, you know, a long time
ago.
Would
that be Macy's? Would that be as far back as
this? This is a Philadelphia. It's a toy shop and delicatessen owned by J.W. Parkinson. So Macy's do get one later on in the century, but this is really early.
Right.
And behind me on the wall, there is an image of Father Christmas, which is a Victorian image, and he's wearing red. There is this myth that Coca-Cola invented him wearing red, and it's just not true. But he wears a variety of colours, doesn't he, Fern? I mean, you've mentioned purple and gold, but we see him also in brown and green. And yellow is very common.
Yeah. But again, these are rural, pastoral, vegetation, yeah, outside, where you can see these sort of colours. It's linking him to a pureness of spirit.
He'd pass the BBC impartiality test during an election debate with the way you just described him, as long as he's wearing all the colours at once.
Not Brexit. He's not. Father Christmas is very much not Brexit, I think.
No, he needs open borders or he's in
exactly.
trouble.
Exactly. How would he get around? He'd be stuck. He'd be stuck in the Irish border.
Sorry, children, I was stuck at Dover due to the backstop being stretched out for all the way from the Irish Sea across the country into the Channel.
Well, of course, I mean, how does he get around? He has, of course, flying reindeer, which is, again,
naturally,
from Clement Moore. Rudolph is a 1940s and 50s invention. So Rudolph comes later, I'm afraid, out of our period.
So this Clement Moore sounds like a bit of potential fraudster then.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
You dangled that tantalisingly earlier on and moved on. Who is Clement Moore? I've never heard of him.
He was an American scholar. He was a very sort of brainy professor, and the poem is accredited to him, but it's not really in his style, and several scholars think that he nicked it from someone else. So
it appears anonymously in the 1823,
I think. Yeah.
And then he supposedly claims credit for it in 1837.
Yeah, it's a little bit later on.
It's quite a lot later. Mm. It's about 15 years later, and he's like, oh, yes, I wrote that.
That was me, yeah, 15 years ago. Yeah,
Christmas legend that I am.
See if you can guess who turns up to join Santa in 1849 in a short story by James Rees.
Well, he doesn't have any sidekicks.
Well,
yeah, like it have to be. It can either be Mrs. Santa.
Hey, nailed it.
Is it?
Yeah, Mrs. Claus. 1849 is the first
that far
mention.
Back.
Yeah, it's the first time that he
that
gets
feels like
married.
Something like Germaine Greer invented in 1973 or something. We need a female Santa to stop the hegemony.
Let's talk Christmas dinner. What do people eat, Fern? Is it turkey? Is it duck? What's on the menu? I'm assuming it's all the standard stuff, but is there anything that might surprise us?
Would you like to know what the Queen was eating in 1897?
Yes, please.
In 1897, the Norwood News delivered this incredible list of what the Queen was having, all served on gold plates, of course.
Nice.
She had woodcock pie, a baron of beef, boar's head and turkey, goose, plum pudding, mince pies, everything.
Yeah, and so mince pies at this period, well, Russell, what do you think's in a mince pie in the 19th century?
I'm hoping that it was originally mince then.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
it's, by the way,
it's like Rachel and Friends. There's meat and there's fruit.
But it is. It's meat and sweet fruit and spices.
I'll be like game
and,
I would imagine. Yeah. Game, I'm not vegan, but I'm trying to eat just proper meat that's been properly sourced. So I've got more into my wild game. I've got over my pigeon and partridge phobias.
Very Victorian.
And
yep,
things like that go so well with blueberries and blackberries and cherries and things like that. So that's not, to me, that's not gross or weird. It'd be more like a pork pie type experience rather than a mince pie type experience.
Very much so. But what sort of shape do you think Victorian mince pies were?
Could be a star for the Star of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. It's a good guess. Do you want to try another
given
one?
Given that it's... Victoria, I wouldn't be surprised if it was phallic, actually. With a piercing through it.
A Prince Albert.
She was notoriously lusty after Albert.
She was. Well, they were lusty anyway. Victorians were incredibly lusty. But this is getting us sidetracked.
Yeah. Star-shaped or oblong, they're my nomination.
Well, oblong is very close. Greg, what do you think?
Well, I would have gone square.
Close, but not quite right.
Okay.
So they were kind of oval-shaped, because they were supposed to represent either a coffin or the manger of baby Jesus.
Well, that's better.
Not only was it that they were a completely different shape, but they were also supposed to tell what religion you were. Because if you were Christian, you would eat the tiny baby Jesus.
Of course, as we all do.
And if you were Jewish, you wouldn't. It was something that they really shifted their understanding. It's not what we would recognise as a mince pie today at all.
So as well as people eating at home, this is also a time of charity. The 19th century has delivered an enormous amount of poverty. There are millions of people coming to the cities who are, a lot of them are really struggling. So we also get soup kitchens, or but bigger than that, Christmas kitchens almost.
Absolutely. And I think we have this idea that the Victorians are very much them and us. You've got the aristocracy and then you've got everyone who's poor and who had nothing because we didn't have a welfare state. It's also this huge period of reform and social care. And from the 1840s onwards, there is this idea that if you are a good Christian person, you are supposed to care for the people around you who have less than you.
Yeah.
It's kind of written into how to be a good Victorian is to do these things. And in 1851, the Leicester Square Soup Kitchen, it feeds on Christmas Day 22,000 people are either homeless or families who are really struggling.
Yeah.
It's this incredible kind of, they take over Leicester Square and they put in this marquee with festive illuminated lights from Soho and beautiful flags and oranges and flowers, and they feed everyone on roast beef, pies, potatoes, bread, lots of plum pudding, jugs of porter, tea, coffee, biscuits, rabbit pies, goose, you know, chestnuts. I could go on and on. Mm. They have 50 cakes. They go through 5,000 pounds of plum pudding on this one day. And it's really this idea that you do care for the people around you, and that at Christmas everyone has a right to something, to be able to celebrate in some way. Mm. And we see these across the country in any of the kind of big towns, Manchester, Newcastle, anywhere. On Christmas Day, there is always an attempt by the Guildhall or anyone else to host a dinner for those who are homeless and to give them the spirit of Christmas. We can sort of look at that and go, oh, how lovely. Mm. But it doesn't take away the poverty that people were then in for the other, ever for the rest of the year.
And that's the argument about, if you read A Christmas Carol as a cynic, you can see that this is a man changed at the end and he's had a profound revelatory experience. But if you read it quite cynically, you can say that here's a man who's like, oh, I'll be nice for a week. And might even slip back into his old ways. But it's an interesting thing. I mean, also in prisons, for example, the guards would serve meals to the inmates who normally they'd be brutalising them. You know, for one day a year, everyone was sort of nice to the poor. And that's an ancient tradition. The idea of patriarchal society where you're meant to sort of be nice to those without power. And we sort of see that all the way parents would be given presents to children. It's a way of transfer of, you know, stuff from those with things to those who don't have. But there is also, by the mid-century, more about giving between equals as well, isn't there?
Very much so. As we get a large middle class and we get a working class that is becoming aspirational, you start to see people sort of going, well, you know, in my newspapers, I've got all these incredible illustrations of Prince Albert with his Christmas tree. Where's my Christmas tree?
And we don't know quite why Boxing Day is called Boxing Day, but the leading theatre... No, it's weird. It's one of these things. You're like, surely we can identify that. But
Boxing Day, and I went, I have no idea.
No, we don't know.
And there's nothing on the internet anywhere.
Well, there's plenty on the internet, but the most...
Boxing things up, surely.
Yeah, the most interesting.
Rather than beating each other up.
Yes, it's not Violence Day. It's not Punching Day.
I always thought it was to do with the boxing.
Punching Day is Christmas Day where I grew up. Everyone drinks too much.
We think it's probably that people would maybe collect things door to door with boxes. They might go around. It might be a collection for the sailors. Or
oh
the
my
local.
God, the Christmas boxes.
Mm. So the Christmas boxes is a 19th century and 18th century tradition.
18th century tradition. Yeah. You'd have the Christmas boxes. Maybe it's just when everyone went around, the Christmas boxes were empty and they gave your Christmas box back.
Possibly, but we think it must be collections, again, for the poor or the needy. We're not quite sure. But what's interesting about Boxing Day is that it's made an official bank holiday in 1871 in England and Wales, but not in Scotland. In Scotland, they get their own local laws. They get to decide more locally, more regionally. So in England and Wales, it's an official bank holiday, has been since then, but in Scotland, different. So yeah, Boxing Day, we're not quite sure what it's called that, but it's a big deal here in Britain. But I'm half French, and in France, Boxing Day is like... Boff, what is Boxing Day? We have no idea. Go on. Because they do Christmas on
Le jour de pugilism.
Yes, everyone comes and they punch the children in the face, as is tradition.
No, le roast beef.
But in France, they do Christmas on the 24th, and Christmas Day is a sort of really boring day of just sitting around feeling a bit like full. So, you know.
So wait, hold on a second. You drop things in to blow people's mind and think you can get away with it. Like you just put the window through of Harrods and then run off. They open their presents on on Christmas Eve?
Yeah, about 8 p.m. through to midnight. So as a kid growing up, I used to go to Paris a lot, and I used to find it really weird. I'd be like, what's going on with Christmas?
Also, why are we doing it at night
time? Same in Germany, same in...
And so the 25th, you still eat the turkey and stuff?
25th is sort of like leftovers day, and you're meant to go to church.
So that's like Boxing Day then?
It's sort of like the Boxing Day, and you go to church and you know, Père Noël might come around, but you'd be like... Not really that.
There's something else I can't abide. Who gets up at 9 and then waits till 8 p.m. to open presents? Mm. What kind of serial killer detachment do you
the
have
French.
From your emotions? No, I mean, seriously, it should only be Ted Bundy that could stare at gifts and go, I have no urge to open them.
Yeah.
Like, if you've got any sort of emotions, you'd be like, give me the gifts now, tear them open.
Well,
at
the other thing there is the Victorians started wrapping gifts in about the 1870s and 80s. Mm. That's when we start to see the.
Oh, so they were naked before.
They were naked before. So when we look
you
at
knew
the,
what you were getting.
You knew what you were getting. Yeah. So under the tree, they just be there.
So you had to stare at a toy soldier and play with it?
Yeah.
Oh, that is very Victorian though, isn't it? Yeah. Look at your toy, but don't touch it.
Let's move on to my favourite thing about the history of Christmas, which is how geniusly bonkers Victorian Christmas cards were. This is what I wrote my undergraduate dissertation on. This is my favourite thing. Russell, we have 16 cards. They're on a slideshow behind us. I'm going to show you them one at a time, and I just want you to react to what you are seeing. So at the moment, we've got one up, which is just Father Christmas looking sort of quite nice.
We've got Sad Santa.
Sad Santa.
Looks like he just got back from Ibiza 2 days ago.
He's bags under the eyes.
Yeah, it's like, I've not got a hangover. Wait a minute. It's Tuesday. I'm crying in the toilet.
Next.
His children riding bats with feathers that look like an analogous for polo sticks.
Yeah.
It's polo bat.
It's basically baby jockeys on bats.
Right, yeah. It's baby jockeys on bats, yeah.
Very Christmassy.
Indeed.
Next
I mean,
one.
It's sort of a mescaline Christmas card, that one. This is an owl riding... Is that a penny farthing?
Yep.
That's an owl riding a penny farthing.
Delivering a message. Yep. Next one.
Wouldn't need a rearview mirror if they're an owl, of course, because they just look straight behind.
Russell, say what you see.
There's some people playing music under a window and then a man's emptying his chamber pot onto the drummer's face.
Literally.
It's like, play drum outside my window, I will empty my piss into your face. That's the moral of that story.
Yeah. Next up.
This is a pair of cocks.
Do you want to just nuance that? Because
I believe, looking by the wattle, and it could be a cock and a chicken.
Yes.
Yes, cock and a hen, rather. And they're on sleds. So it's a man and a woman's body with a cock and chicken head riding a sled. I mean, it's what you would draw at 6 a.m. if you just mixed acid with MDMA.
Let's see this.
I mean, this is getting really weird now. What is a plum pudding? I mean, I've let you get away with that over and over again. I never had plum pudding, so that could be a plum pudding with two things stuck in its face, like a carving knife and a carving fork. And instead of legs, it's got two port bottles and on its head a dish with a glass.
And it's grinning.
Is it a plum pudding?
It's sort of, it's a Christmas
what
pudding.
What is a plum pudding?
It's basically just... It's
Christmas pudding?
Yeah, really heavy, dense, thick.
And the next one?
Well, this is the card everyone wants to receive. It's a dead robin with its withering feet up in the air. It's like the most heartbreaking card. And with a caption, may yours be a joyful Christmas. The implication being, this robin sodding well didn't have a joyful Christmas as he's dead. This is as bad as it gets.
Next up, what do you see here, Russell?
It looks like it could be a mangled wurzel or a turnip or a parsnip walking along.
Yep.
And on the top of it is Jacob Rees-Mogg with a monocle and a top hat. And he's holding a strawberry heart wheat thing that says Merry Christmas to you.
Yeah, it's literally the body of a parsnip at the face of Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Which is Jacob Rees-Mogg's body, actually. Yeah. And I heard he's made of parsnip.
This one?
I mean, this is a beautiful card. It says, Happy Christmas, a hearty welcome. And the image is snow, it's chilly, and it's a man being ripped apart by a bear. It's just the part of Christmas everyone misses.
The giant polar bear just eviscerating a man.
I often like to just watch Leonardo DiCaprio in the Reverend on a Sunday art. Very, very Christmas film that.
Oh, yeah.
Leonardo DiCaprio recovering from bear claws in the woods.
Yep.
I feel like we've all taken something because this is a mouse riding a lobster with a shopping list.
Yep. My favourite one. Last one.
Well, this is a great, it says, let's read the caption. It says, glad Christmas, what did that bade me?
Yeah, glad Christmas bade me, happy make your new year, and so I thought I'd give you something fun.
Which is beautiful, and it's a Christmas scene, two Victorian bobbies on the beat, except one of them is about to be stabbed with a red hot rod by a clown that's literally scarier than it.
Yes. Yeah, and then my absolute favourite one is two children being harassed by a giant wasp.
Yeah, exactly.
So those are Victorian Christmas cards.
They seem to like a horrific image, nice text.
Yes.
Yeah. And they love animal scenes. They love animals doing human things. They really love natural things, because Christmas cards originated actually as Valentine's cards. So they're often very romantic and spring imagery. But the really important thing about Christmas cards is that they massively blossomed in the 19th century because of the invention of the stamp, as you've mentioned, the postal system, the railway system. And it brings people together who are separated by the empire and by distance and so on. So the Christmas card starts off a very small thing. It's invented in 1843 by Henry Cole.
1840s again.
Yeah. And then by the end of the century, there are millions and millions and millions of them. And they are beautiful aesthetic objects. They
some
get reviewed.
Some of them are very surreal.
Yeah, they're some of the finest artists in the land are making them, and they get reviewed critically. They get people go to exhibitions of them, but you keep them and you store them. I just want to quickly say the two weirdest things that I've seen in a Victorian Christmas card. One was a slice of bacon.
In the card,
and the other
what
was
a real bit of bacon.
Real bit of bacon stapled in, and the other was a dead mouse.
Who puts a dead mouse in a card?
Exactly.
Is it from one cat?
The psychopath.
From the dog to the cat, America. Now, so we have a debate in our house. Now, I'm not taking away from this period in history where obviously sending a card was one of the only communications, but it's not anymore. It's, relevance is dead. Now, I am by no means have conducted a sociological or demographic study that could be underwritten by an academic. However, I have played to over 110,000 people already on this tour. So that's a sizable slice of Britain. The number of men who like sending or receiving cards compared to the number of women, I'm going to say about 2%. Interestingly, my gay friends say that they do send cards to each other. We're talking about straight men hate cards. They don't just not send them, they detest them. Cards have become gendered, the idea of giving and receiving and writing in it, because it's the most important bit and shows the thought and all that. I hate. What is it about cards that are so repulsive and annoying to almost all men? And we got one of the biggest arguments me and Lindsay had was I didn't get a Mother's Day card from the baby to her on the first Mother's Day because no one sat me down and told me I was going to have a weird, messed up Freudian day where I'm going to have to pretend my wife is my mum and do fake crayons for the day, which I think is sick and weird. So if the Victorians started that, they're responsible for so many arguments.
Yeah.
And it's a man who invents it. So Henry Cole invents it because he's got so many friends and he's tired of writing letters.
But they had a purpose then.
Yeah, they
now
did.
We have email and loads of other things. It's not 1840 anymore. Merry Christmas, 281.
The nuance window!
So we need to move on. We've reached a part of the show that's my favourite part. This is where Russell and I allow Fern to talk uninterrupted for 2 minutes. It's called the Nuance Window. And this is where our expert gets to talk about her specialist area. Fern is a historian of pop culture and specifically, as well as the history of sexuality, music hall is her real thing. So, Fern, you get 2 minutes. I'm going to get my stopwatch up. Without much further ado, the Nuance Window. Off you go.
So I'm going to take you back from our history of crackers with H.J. Smith and the London Pavilion to the music halls. Now, the music halls are, again, a Victorian invention. In 1843, the Theatres Regulation Act allows for us to have music hall, because before that point, theatre is the only drama that we're allowed. We're not allowed anything else on the stage. And the music halls come out of the song and supper rooms that people are going to, that you pay money, you get a song and you get your supper. Those are male-only places, things like the Coal Room in London. And they're people like Thackeray and Dickens love to go to these because you get a bawdy song, you get your supper and you have fun. And when the Theatres Act comes along, a whole load of publicans go, bloody hell, women come in my pub, but they're not allowed into the song and supper rooms. If I make a room that everyone can go in that has bawdy songs and fun and other acts, I could actually make some money here. And from this, the kind of the music halls explode. And it happens really fast. In 1851, we get the Canterbury Music Hall, which is the very first music hall in London. And it's the one that has this carpet of 1,000 guineas and your seats are threepence. And you can come in, whoever you are, you get to see singers, comedians, anything you like, to become this, to just really have fun. What's central to the entire musical period, of course, is the pantomime. Mm. And pantomime becomes what we know today, which is this big Christmas tradition. But in the Victorian period, it goes for 4 months. So if you don't like Christmas, apart from in December, as a Victorian comedian, you would have made your money in the Christmas period in pantomime, and it would have run for 4 months. You would not have been able to get out of Dick Whittington. You would have been in that every single night. It's kind of this amazing thing. And anyone who is a music hall act wants to be in it. And from that, from this kind of joy of these pantomimes, which have like a cast of 2,000, ballet, opera, anything in it, we get the spectacle of what we have as pantomime today.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
So cool.
Nailed it. 2 minutes, 3 seconds.
That was nothing.
I've learned so much today.
Well, mainlining, we're going to find out how much you've learned, because now...
You're not going to test me on what we've discussed,
are you? Oh, yeah. So what do you know now? This is the quiz. We've got a quick fire. It's 10 questions.
Everything you're going to ask me, we've already discussed.
Everything basically everything that we've mentioned in the show, we're now going to see if you were listening or not. And you're a clever, intelligent man, but you've had several coffees, so
I have natural brightness, but my memory, let's just say I've been to Ibiza 18 times, and the short term isn't what it was.
No worries at all. Don't worry. I'm a very generous marker.
My knowledge of techno, amazing.
All right. Okay. You ready?
Okay.
We've got a minute on the clock. 10 questions. So, here we go. First question. So, Henry Cole invented what in 1843 to contact his friends at Christmas?
Christmas cards.
Yes. Boxing Day was made a bank holiday in 1871, apart from in which
Scotland.
British country? Yes, Scotland, absolutely. Why did Lewis Carroll acquire the nickname The Christmas Carol?
Because he so desperately wanted his books to be Christmassy.
Absolutely. Which German royal first introduced Christmas trees into
Caroline.
Britain? Yes. In 1847, Tom Smith allegedly invented the modern cracker. What did he call it?
He called it...
the porn film.
Something Expectations.
Yep.
Exploding Expectations.
Bangs of Expectations.
Bangs of Expectations with his brother H.G. H.J.
Very yes. well remembered.
Correct.
What was different about Victorian mince pies to ours?
They contained meat.
Absolutely, very.
And it was oval. They were oval as well.
In the 1820s, the American scholar Clement Moore allegedly wrote the famous poem featuring reindeer, which was called...
It was The Night Before Christmas.
It absolutely was, although it's sometimes called A Visit from St. Nicholas. Christmas cards started out as part of which other earlier festival in February?
Oh,
a romance festival.
I missed that one. Valentine's.
Valentine's
maybe?
It is, yep. In 1841 in Philadelphia, Santa Claus appeared in which place for the first time?
Parkinson's store in Philadelphia.
Department store, absolutely right. Parkinson's. And well remembered on the name. And in 1849, which character joined Father Christmas, or rather St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, by his side?
He married her in a civil partnership.
Mrs. Claus, I'm giving you 10 out of 10 there, because you delivered
extra
some
facts.
Quality extra facts there. I think you absolutely aced it. Well done, Russell.
Oh, my God. I would have listened so much harder if I'd have remembered this happened at the end of this phone, so I genuinely wasn't concentrating fully.
I'm not feeling like a Grinch. I'm feeling like a nice Christmassy guy. I think you did really well.
Thank you.
Amazing. Well, we've pretty much run out of time there, so if you've enjoyed hearing us basically build snowman and then punch it in the face with facts, then make sure to share this podcast with your friends, leave a review, like and subscribe. The show is called You're Dead to Me. A huge thank you again to our marvellous guests in History Corner, Dr. Fern Riddell, and in Comedy Corner, the amazing Russell Candy Cane. Did you enjoy it, Russell? Have you learned some stuff?
I loved it. I'm fascinated by the Victorians and the conflicted things we have about them. Their prudery mixed with their liberality.
You need to talk to Fern, because this is her area of expertise.
The reputation of prudery
thank
mixed with the reality. It's just, it fascinates me. They're like the pupil stage of us, from the larvae of the Middle Ages to us as modern butterflies.
That's a nice analogy.
A very good analogy.
Love it. Well, we're off to yank our bangs of expectation in the hope of cracking one off. Honestly, those Victorians were filthy.
Someone milk Greg, for Christ's sake.
Merry Christmas and farewell. You're Dead to Me was a Muddy Knees Media production for BBC Sounds. The script was written and researched by myself, and the producer was Cornelius Mendes.
Hi, I'm Hugh Dennis, and I'd like to tell you about the Radio 4 Christmas Appeal. Over its long history, listeners have supported St Martin in the Fields and helped thousands of people away from homelessness and into a safe and secure place to live. How? Well, all over the UK, emergency grants of up to £350 help people to pay a deposit on a flat or pay rent arrears to avoid eviction. Frontline workers offer encouragement and challenge so people aren't alone while they get their lives back together. And in London, the connection at St Martin's helps people off the streets and to find a home. Please support the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal with St Martin in the Fields by donating online on the Radio 4 website. If you want to hear how your support is helping, you can go to BBC Sounds and listen to a programme all about the Christmas appeal called Making a Difference with Asma Mia. Whether you're a long-standing donor or this is your first year, thank you. Home starts here.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're after more fascinating stories from the past on everything from medieval peasants to World War II pilots, then why not check out the History Extra podcast? Made by the team behind BBC History Magazine, History Extra brings you conversations with the world's leading historians. Subscribe for fresh takes on history's most famous figures and compelling deep dives into lesser-known events. Just search for History Extra to listen wherever you get your podcasts.